make him an offer again with you.
I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Stuff that dreams are made of.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
One morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How he got in my pajamas, I don't know.
I am big. It's the picture that got small.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Hello and welcome to Front Row Classics, a production of the Front Row Network of Shows, where we take a look at some of the greatest films ever made. And here's your host, Brandon Davis.
And hello to everybody out there in podcast land. This is the Front Row Network. I'm your host, Brandon Davis, with Front Row Classics, with NPR Illinois Community Voices. And it's time to haul out the holly and put up the tree before our spirit falls again. That reference works, not quite with this movie, but with the franchise. So yeah. We'll get into it. But it is holiday season, and you know, we've been talking about some heavier stuff the last few months. So it's time to get into a little bit more of the joyful spirit of the season here on Front Row Classics. And so it's time to talk about Auntie Mame from 1958, which isn't necessarily a Christmas movie, but has a wonderful Christmas section in it, and I think exemplifies the spirit of the holiday season at its best. So we'll get into that. But I have joining with me my co-host Eric Flick. How's it going, Eric?
Brandon's going well. Happy holidays to you.
You too, you too. And also joining us, first time in a while for Classics, actually, is Brett Rutherford. How's it going, Brett?
Great, thank you. It's good to be back, and thank you for inviting me. This is a great movie. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, this is a fun movie. We Eric, when I was going down the list of the movies that we talked about so far in 2020, we really haven't talked about a lot of female-led films. We've talked about movies with a lot of testosterone in them. So this is a nice switch to talk about a real star vehicle, and this is a great star vehicle for Rosalind Russell, which we'll get into definitely. But Eric, before we get into first impressions, you want to give a little plot summary for Auntie Mame?
Sure. So our titular Auntie Mame is the aunt of one Patrick Dennis. And at the beginning of the film, we find out that Patrick, who was living with his father in Chicago, has become an orphan. His father's passed away, and he's sent to live with his aunt, who from the very beginning of the movie, we come to realize is a free spirit character. And so Patrick arrives at her apartment in New York City, where she's throwing a party with, would you say, her bohemian friends?
Her eclectic group of friends.
It's a very eclectic group. And so we come to learn a little bit more about Auntie Mame, and the rest of the movie's a bit of a serialized story of her life. The next thing that happens to them, Patrick comes to live with her, and we discover that his father's left him a trust, which is managed by a Mr. Babcock, who wants young Mr. Dennis to be educated in a more conservative fashion. And so we begin to have the push and pull of the sort of conservative upbringing and the free spirited lifestyle that Mame lives. And we quickly learn too that this being 1928, even though it actually took place in 1929, the stock market crashes and Mame has become has gone from wealthy socialite to rather penniless overnight. And so then she tries her hand at a couple of jobs. And in one of those jobs at a department store where she's having a lot of difficulty selling roller skates, she meets and falls in love with a oil tycoon. So then our story takes us to meet his family in the southern part of the United States. Hilarity ensues there. And then on a multi-year honeymoon with her new husband, unfortunately, he falls off of a mountain and dies. But Mame, having inherited his wealth, returns to New York City after traveling around some more. Patrick grows up and has been influenced by his conservative schooling, and is about to marry a young woman, and brings that woman to meet his Auntie Mame, who helped raise him. And things don't go well there for the happy couple, but we have a happy ending because he meets another woman at the party, has a grandson who Auntie Mame intends to bring under her wing, just like she did her dear Patrick.
Yeah. So yeah. Let's start with though our first impressions of the film, and Brett, we'll start with you.
I was not familiar. I was more familiar with the musical Mame, but wanted to watch the source material, and especially as a fan of Rosalind Russell from other films like The Women and all of those. She's what brought me to the film, and it was great. It was charming. I like, the period part of the, well, it's all a period piece, but so that was really interesting. And it was just, it's nice to, it made me think, when this film came out, that this, the Mame character was probably living a little bit more of a bohemian lifestyle, or a little bit more eccentric and interesting than most of the audience who would come see that. So right now, when we watch it from our perspective, it's a little, okay, yeah, but it was probably a little bit more of a shock when it first came out. So my first impression was that I had enjoyed it very much, and I think we're probably going to talk about the film version of Mame, probably, that this stands up very well. So the tests of time. So.
Eric, what are your first impressions?
My first experience with Mame as a character was the musical as well. And I think I saw the 70s Lucille Ball version, and I think I turned it off. I think I remember seeing that, back in the mid 80s at some point, and not liking that at all. And so I didn't have a good flavor for this movie, and probably caught it in the early 2000s at some point. And my first impression of it then, and was still my first impression of it this time, is that it is hilarious. It's a really funny movie. Mame is a really funny character. Rosalind Russell's a genius. I mean, she kills it in every aspect of this movie. And what I really like is that you got a really great character, and you've got an actress who doesn't need anyone else around her to be hilarious. But the movie is at its best when she's trading zingers with some of the other characters too. And then you've got a really good supporting cast all around her. This movie probably doesn't get the credit that it deserves for being a comedy stalwart, which is really what it is.
Mm-hmm. It's the definition of a star vehicle, but it's also a wonderful ensemble of people. You have funny characters who come on and they don't do a whole lot, but they all get their little chances to hit a home run every now and then. And they have the perfect sparring partner to play off of them, being Rosalind Russell. And she works brilliantly as a straight man and as, the comedic foil and in certain sections of the film. And it's such an original character, and she plays it so brilliantly. And like I said, I think it's the definition of a feel-good movie. You walk away just, with a wonderful feeling about the human race, which is something we really need toward the end of this year. And it lifts your spirits. And, this was adapted. It started out as a book. I mean, the lineage of this movie is crazy, because started out as a popular novel, becomes a popular play, becomes a popular movie, becomes a popular musical, and then becomes a not so popular movie musical.
Spoiler alert.
But, But yeah, I mean, it's a character. I'm surprised we haven't gotten another sort of rendition of it lately, because it's a character I feel that can sort of live on. And definitely, I mean, but you have someone who played it so brilliantly as Rosalind Russell. But the movie, I actually want to give credit to the director of this movie, Morton DaCosta, who, this is his first film that he directed. And I think of all the directors that we're ever going to talk about on Classics, he might have the shortest filmography, 3 movies. he directs this movie, and then 4 years later directs the film version of The Music Man, which is another success. And then the year after that, he directs a movie called Island of Love, which is a flop, and then never directs another movie again. So it's a little sad, because he does some wonderful, interesting things with the camera in this movie that I want to talk about later on. But let's
not feel bad for him, because he was a movie producer, and I think
that's true.
He elected himself to direct those movies because he had a clear vision for him. But I think he was producing other movies.
Well, and he was a stage director, so he directed the stage version of this. So I think he was fine being in the theater.
Yeah.
But wonderful, wonderful visual eye, which we'll talk about. But let's talk about the actual characters in the movie first, starting with Annie Mame, played by Rosalind Russell, who, like you said, is a superstar through this whole thing. And Eric, we'll start with you though. What attributes, best describe Rosalind Russell as Annie Mame?
Whoo, eccentric, but at the same time loving. From the minute she realizes that she's got a kid to look after, she gives him the nickname of her little love, and she absolutely adores that kid. The relationships that she's got with her friends, the people that work for her, also let you know that she is a very loving person. She can have a real acerbic wit about her, but she's got a very, very kind heart. And that comes out in every scene. And like you said, Brandon, it makes you joyful. So it's really fun to watch. The other thing is that she's very smart. She speaks several languages, or is at least has a passing familiarity with them, and is worldly. And she's very, very quick on her feet. And so it's a real whirlwind watching her perform, watching Rosalind Russell perform this character on film. I can't imagine what it would have been like on stage. I imagine it was just electric. But it comes across in this movie too.
Yeah, Brett.
Well, she's a woman with a point of view, she's like one of those characters that she wants to share her experiences and this sort of greater worldview than probably a lot of people do. And she wants to share that with, this nephew of hers and actually her friends and everyone. And she's the life of the party all of the time. So, she's just a joy to be around, and it's clear why the characters in this show want to party with her and have a good time. So
it's like at the very end of the movie when Pegeen says, she's the Pied Piper. She is, because she's a modern day version of that. It's like she's a Peter Pan sort of for the ages too. She creates this wonderful world for her nephew, and it's the opening credits of the movie, you just see these hands with the kaleidoscope, and I'm like, she creates this kind of kaleidoscope world for her nephew, who's sort of lived in, everybody likes to praise his father, but it sounds like life with his father was not the greatest life.
There might be a little bit of extra drinkies in that.
Yeah.
So in his world too.
So yes.
Be quiet, I'm hung. I'm like going, okay. Daddy.
No, but what I love about her is this is a woman who has never had a chance to be maternal in her whole life. And when she has the opportunity presented to her, she grabs it and she takes it, as fast as she can. Because, she makes a flippant comment at the beginning. She's ready to throw the kid in the river. And then when she finds out she's his nephew, I mean, she's immediately taken to it. And, you know, I love, you know, we'll talk about scenes later, but I love the scene where, you know, she's trying to figure out how to cover him up when he's falling asleep in the chair, and she uses all of her robes and her wraps.
Grabs a fur, sure.
But yeah, she's amazing. And also, I just, Rosalind Russell's body language in this movie, she's almost like a dancer, because she's constantly, mm-hmm. she's constantly moving. And she, and you know, just with the rapid fire dialogue, she never takes a breath hardly. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing, because you understand every word. And it's, yeah, I mean, it's a really, really unique performance. And you're right. I can't imagine what it would have been like on stage.
But it's also, well, yeah, since she was on stage, she probably had, mm-hmm. well, she had, I don't know how many performances it ran for, but she got to kind of work through her character in so many different ways that, you know, she just, I'm sure when it was time to film, she just said, let's give them this, you know, this always works. This is good. So how cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and if I recall correctly, it was something like over 600 performances that the show ran. So it was probably real easy for her to pick up that character and put it in different situations. And mm-hmm. exactly like you said, Brett, and here's how Mame's going to react in those situations.
Mm-hmm. And she is a very forward, I mean, the stuff that she's spouting is very forward-thinking for the late 50s. I mean, let alone the 20s and
30s. Right, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. So that was cool.
Yeah, mm-hmm. it's a very modern movie. I mean, for the late 50s, and I think even past the late 50s even, because, yeah. I mean, she...
Because we're kind of back there again, so come on. It's time... to watch does, it again.
Yeah, she does. I mean, she doesn't even just have, she doesn't have to preach anything. She just lives it. And mm-hmm. and it's really amazing, because there's such amazing warmth to her. And I think it's, you know, and yeah, we'll get into scenes, because those keep popping in my head. We'll talk about them later. But let's talk about, I guess let's talk about the character of Patrick, who's played by two actors, Jan Hanslick, who plays the young Patrick, and Roger Smith, who plays the older Patrick. And I think both actors do a fine job with their roles. I think Jan Hanslick's a very good child actor. I think he's much more mature than his years would have you to believe, it feels
well,
like.
Well, he certainly enunciates well. Yes. Sorry, I didn't give you a good example of that, but he certainly enunciates well for a child actor. In fact, it's a little off-putting. I'm like going, seriously, it's just, and I don't know. I'm like going, it was just slightly off-putting, but, you know, only for a moment. I'm like going, use the contraction, dude. Seriously. Anyway, no.
But I don't know is that part of the sort of elongated prose of the time, though? And I couldn't tell if he was over enunciating or if that was, this is how a kid would have been trained to speak in a, you know, boarding school type.
And,
yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Possibly.
And even Rosalind Russell, when she speaks as Mame, there's almost that lilt, there's that almost Britishness to the accent. In fact, there's the funny line in there where they're talking about the other character who they believe has an English accent. She says, no, she's from Pittsburgh. And, well, why does she speak like that? Well, when you're from Pittsburgh, you have to do something. But there, you know, there's a certain ton of airs that especially East Coast people, I think at the time, would have been doing. And I felt like that maybe was what that character or right. what that actor was instructed to do with that character's enunciation.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was a directorial choice or the actor's choice, because when older Patrick does not have that elongated pronunciation.
Well, that is true. Now, and the younger actor, he followed from the stage show too, correct? Right.
I believe so. So he's giving a stage performance.
Exactly. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah, that's true.
So he's,
yeah.
He's speaking to the balcony when he's performing.
Yeah. Yeah. Whereas I'm sure Rosalind Russell's performance on the stage was even more exaggerated, but having been in movies before that, I'm sure she knew how to adjust to in front of a camera. But I also think his elongated speech is much more shocking, just because he's up against her, who's so clipped and fast with the way that she's talking.
Yes.
I do love younger Patrick, just because he really takes to this world that she's creating for him, and he just goes with the flow.
He learns how to make a mean martini.
He does.
And his vocabulary improves immensely.
He knows how to put drunk Broadway divas to sleep.
All those wonderful life lessons. You know, you never know when that's going to happen. You know.
I do enjoy that. And then older Patrick, I mean, he doesn't really get anything, you know, as interesting to do, I don't think. He's just more there to react toward the end. But I think he's very accessible and does a great job. And really, you even though he hasn't been, you know, in the movie, you know, as long as we've seen the younger Patrick, you feel the history between them when he's talking. He doesn't feel like he's just been transplanted into the story.
And it's not a jarring transition from younger to older. So I think that the story is well served with how they chose those actors.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the movie is filled with a bunch of great character performances, and I'm sure we'll touch on a lot of those when we get to scenes, but I do want to point out a couple. Coral Brown as Vera Charles, who is just hilarious, and Coral Brown, who was Mrs. Vincent Price in real life.
Wow. Yeah. How cool.
Yeah. And mainly a stage actress, didn't do a ton of movies, but I think she and Russell have great, you know, love hate chemistry, especially in the, you know, great, you know, play scene. But I think that she has some wonderful, really, really funny moments.
I think so too. Yeah. She's, you know, well, she's the Pittsburgh diva, and she is very much the diva in all of the best aspects, you know. So she gets to, we get to see that, to contrast her a little bit to Mame. You know, she's a good foil for her too. So
she is a great foil, and there's chemistry between the two. It's
I was never in the chorus, you know. So like I love that.
But there's almost a Lucy Ethel chemistry between the two.
Yeah.
Like you could totally see those two having their drinks beginning at, you know, some at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and just getting into trouble with some antics. And it comes across, it's played really well.
Yeah. And you're right. They just strike you as, you know, the kind of friends that can have the biggest, you know, drag out fight, and then, you know, a day later, the best of friends again. And she's always there for her. And and she has some wonderful, wonderful moments. Another great character, though, of course, is her husband, Beauregard Jackson Pickett Burnside. Mm-hmm. And I like Forrest Tucker. I think he's a great actor, and he really brings that Southern gentlemanly warmth, and he's like a breath of fresh air when he comes to the movie, because you've seen all these eccentric bohemian characters coming in and out, and here's this, you know, really laid back Southern guy, and it's like, you know, he's this breath of fresh air in Mame's life. You know, he's the, you know, white knight she's been waiting for. But yeah, he brings a nice calm energy to the movie.
I think it is great when he comes in, and I mean, and then, of course, when he takes her down south to show her off, well, that's fun, too. So.
Yeah, again, unfortunately, gets a very untimely death in the movie. But,
you know,
life goes on, I guess. That's the point.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the lesson here. Yeah. I'm like going, I have your money. I love you so much. And now, well, you know, take that picture or whatever, you know. So. Oops.
But there, I mean, what's great is that character's given funny scenes without being a comedic character at all. you know, loading him down with the several different cameras and having him take pictures everywhere they go. It's just a funny choice.
Yeah, and it's truthful, because you we all have that uncle who'll take picture from any angle or any direction.
Yeah. Ooh, gosh, if they would have had selfies then, he would have been gone before.
Right,
then, you know?
Right.
Oh, my gosh. Grand Canyon, yeah. And they would have been gone, you know? So, oops.
Yeah, it's great. And then the one I really need to point out, though, is Peggy Cass, who plays Agnes Gooch, who we'll talk about Oscars later, but aside from Russell, is the other Oscar-nominated performance from the movie. She comes in halfway through the movie and just steals it. And she, along with Russell and young Patrick, they were the three that were from the original Broadway cast. So this was a character she had played 400 times as well, and she just has a great handle on it, and she gets some of the best lines in the second act of the movie, and I just I love that character so much, and she it's like nails on a chalkboard, her voice, but you just feel for this character, because she's being dragged into these situations that she never would have been dragged into before,
but really really hilarious. You're right. She steals every scene that she's in. And I keep wanting her to come back on screen. You know, it's like, give me more of Agnes Gooch.
And what a great name.
Right.
I love the way, you know, you're not sure about her, but then, you know, once you realize that, she's a strange character, but she's on her game when she can write down every single word that Mame says and how many words, 180 words. Yeah, absolutely fantastic. And there's a lot of other characters, but there's a lot of great scenes in this movie. We'll get to them now. So Brett, we'll start with you. What's one of your favorite scenes in the movie?
Well, I think all of the different jobs that Mame has, you know, from telephone operator, which is, you know, that's just her. She was just, you know, the camera's on her and she's doing her. Well, I mean, the scene sort of sets itself up, you know, you're an inept telephone operator. So, you know, that's going to be a fun situation. And then when she's an actress and her scene with Patrick, when Patrick sees the play and, you know, the Lord Dudley is so, you know, so sweet, you know, so that's great. And then Macy's department store, which leads you into Beauregard Jackson Pickett Burnside, which I guess, but he's named after all the different Southern generals?
It's all of his names are Civil War generals. I think some are Confederate, some are Union.
Yeah.
Oh, but yeah. Okay.
We don't have to say all four every time, do we?
No.
I called him Beauregard JPB. You know? Okay. I'm like going,
no,
so
but
that's what I did.
But yeah, that scene where she does the whole telephone operator stuff, and I wrote down that Whittacombe, Gutterman, Applewhite, Bibberman, and Black. If that's not a tongue twister.
It's a bit of it. Yes.
Yeah, but it's just an amazing script, right? And I don't know it, but I'm sure that was lifted directly from the play and put there. I mean,
yeah,
it's just an amazing amount of wordplay, and then she gets to do those things that Brett was just doing. And then she makes the wild claim, you know, somebody's trying to get connected with San Francisco. Well, San Francisco doesn't even exist. I mean, just joke after joke in that. It's a sight gag too. It's just such a comedy jewel right in the middle of this movie that you could pull that clip out and stick it on YouTube or TikTok and people would still watch it today.
Ooh, okay.
Challenge accepted. Well,
it goes to the writing, which is, you know, Compton and Green, you know.
Yeah,
they're not the screenplay slackers, you know. Yeah. So I'm sure that was, you know, their work. So just so good.
Yeah, I'm interested because I've never seen the stage play of this, and I'd love to see how much dialogue was actually pulled from the stage play and how much Compton and Green added into it, because it's seamless, you know, no matter what, which was what, it all works brilliantly. But yeah, I love the scene in Macy's too, you know, when she, you know, yells at him about getting the skates, get him at Gimbel's.
Yeah, get him at Gimbel's.
And I just love the fact
C-O-D.
That the
COD.
Yes, she's
C-O-D.
Only
COD.
She's so wanting everybody to do it because she can't figure out how to take a cash check. I mean, it's just,
you know.
Yeah, it's just
with
so
her paperwork
funny.
That is just, you know, this ribbons of triplicates and all
yes.
that sort of stuff. So cute.
Yeah. So. Eric, do you have a favorite scene?
You know, when we first meet Mame and she is buzzing around the party and interacting with these other characters that really don't have to do anything either. You know, it starts off before we even meet her. We meet her apartment, which is
yes.
which is truly a character in this
mm-hmm.
And probably has most. As many costume changes as many of the other characters, too.
I think it changes 7 times.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah.
But yeah. When we first see it, there's a large dragon on the door. And when the bell's rung, the dragon's eyes open and human eyes are behind it to see who's outside there. The peephole is the eyes of the dragon. And then we see Mame, you know, walking around and there's a great part where she's talking to he's a royalty of some sort who just wrote a symphony, and she turns to the other party guest and says, "Have you heard it?" And she says, "Well, yes, I've heard it. I'm his wife." And she just says, you know, "Well, I'm sure you've heard it," and then just moves on. You know, she
it
hasn't offended
on.
Yeah, and she shakes hands with a monkey really briefly and just moves on. I mean, she's just like flitting around the room, and you just immediately get the idea. You know this character. You've got a relative like this who is a social butterfly and has to move like that in order to survive. And I think it's just a really well done scene.
Yeah, there's so many jewels in that little bit. You know, the one that I always remember is, you know, every time you hear a word you don't understand, write it down.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when he comes back with the words that he's heard, you know, libido.
And that's for
Bingo,
yeah.
Karl yes. Marx. Is he one of the Marx brothers? Yeah. And then once he gets to heterosexual, that's when she goes, "You won't need to know some of these words for months."
for months. That's fun. Yeah. And those were probably slightly adjusted from the play, I'm thinking.
Oh, I bet.
You know?
Yeah.
But still,
it was as close to the line as they could get,
you know,
for the code.
Right. So, you know, it's still
fun. Because we're in 1958 and movies are starting to get a little more lenient in terms of some of that stuff, but you still couldn't cross certain lines. I do love the whole Christmas section of the movie. You know, mm-hmm. we talked about the department store, but I love after she's been fired and she's walking down the street, and she's got like a dime left in her purse and she realizes she doesn't have enough for a cab, but she gives the only dime she has left to the Salvation Army. That explains Mame's character right there. Mm-hmm. You know, the giving, generous person she is. And then, you know, you get back to the apartment, and of course it's the, you know, every time I see that sequence, I expect them to break out into singing Christmas. But it's just a great scene because of this family that they've created. You know, Nora, who arrived with Patrick from day one, who never expected to like Mame, you know, loves her just as much as Patrick does. You know, she says, you know, "You're a loving woman, ma'am. You're odd, but you're loving." And then Ito, the butler, and I just love the scene where Nora and Ito reveal that, you know, they've paid the rest of the grocery bill for the year, and Rosalind Russell plays that perfectly about how she'll pay them mm-hmm. back one day. And yeah, it's a great scene and really exemplifies, you know, the spirit of Christmas, the spirit of the holidays, and what it's all about.
Yeah, yes. And it's really heartwarming. It's really touching. You know, if they ever go back and re-examine this movie, you know, this scene, there is the white knight that comes in and saves the day. Mm-hmm. At the same time, you get the understanding that when Mame is telling those individuals that work for her that she's going to pay them back, she doesn't need that guy to do it. You know,
no.
Even though she got fired from Macy's the day before, she's going to go back out there and find something else to do. You know, she was going to do whatever it took. It just so happened that this guy came into her life. So I appreciated that about this movie. You know, that would probably be something today we just strip out. There doesn't need to be the male hero figure that comes in to save her. But I think they did a good job of saying she didn't need saving. he just happened to be there. And then they make a point that she is happy with him. She falls in love with him.
Yeah.
Right. That's the attraction, and that, yeah, the money's just, you know, a nice thing.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, so an added bonus. Ha ha.
Yeah, well, and we have to talk, talking about him, we have to talk about the whole sequence when they're in the South, and she's, you know, being plotted against by Sally Cato, who, you know, puts her on this, you know, rogue horse, you know, and, yeah. But the whole physical comedy of the Fox Hunt is amazing, and that's one of Rosalind Russell's great, you know, star moments in the movie, you know, and I love the whole, you know, she's passing the dogs, you know, mother of Jefferson Davis, she's passing the fox.
Before she even gets on the horse, though, she's walking around with these boots that don't fit, and it's just it's a hilarious sight gag there, too. This character that we've seen, very postured all the time, can't get the shoes on her feet, so she just leaves them hanging off and walks around in them. It's just hilarious.
Right.
Yeah, fun.
Yeah. Well, and then, of course, we've talked about most of the first act of the movie, but the second act, once Agnes Gooch and then Brian, what's the last name of the character?
O'Banion.
Brian O'Banion, yeah.
Yeah.
Comes in, and Mame is, you know, Bo has died, and Patrick thinks that Mame needs a distraction, so he's encouraged her to write her memoir, and so Agnes is going to be the typist, and Brian's going to be, you know, sort of the ghostwriter for her, and, you know, Patrick comes in and wants to introduce him to his new fiance, and she's trying to get rid of Brian, so she sends Agnes out. And that's a great sequence, and that leads to, you know, the famous line of the movie, you know, life is a banquet and most poor suckers are starving to death. Mm-hmm. And that's really that's why the whole point of the movie, but it's a hilarious sequence leading up to that, you know, when she's trying to make over Agnes. Totally out of her element.
Some success, yes, yeah. You know.
Yeah, Peggy Cass was an attractive woman, yeah.
Sure, you know. Cinch that waist in just a little bit more. But other than that, yeah, I'm like going, you're kind of tubular there, dear, but, you know, you're ready for your party. Okay.
What's great is the voice doesn't change, though.
Yeah.
Right. You know, they change the entire exterior of that character, but the way she speaks doesn't change one iota, and it's great. It makes it even more jarring whenever her mouth opens up has that sort of nails on a chalkboard voice.
And that Brian changes his tune, you know, that when he finds out that she might, you know, be a little bit more means. She's just doing this for a lark, that she is of means, and that, yeah, so that suddenly ups her, level of attractiveness.
Yes. You know? Yes.
So, yeah.
The thing that I was thinking about when I watched it this time was, I don't know if they added it for the movie or if it was in the play, you know, Agnes goes out on the town with Brian that night. And then, of course, turns out she's pregnant later on. And then, of course, we, you know, for a long while in the movie, we think she's, you know, an unwed mother. And then she gets that telegram at the end that, no, her and Brian really are married. I was wondering if they added that in the movie just to please the movie censors of the time, or that was really in the play. I don't think it was in the play, because I'm thinking about in Mame. Yeah. I don't think I think that she remains unwed the whole time.
But it's clever the way they handled it that. Yeah. I feel like I was in a movie, you know, and I wasn't in a movie. It was me.
He wasn't Gary Cooper.
Yes. That was fun.
Yeah. My other, of course, the other big subplot in the movie, because this movie really, it's not a huge linear plot. It's more episodic, kind of. But what I find interesting is, like all teenagers, all young people, Patrick rebels, but in a very different way. You know, he was brought up with a very liberal, open lifestyle, and he rebels by becoming conservative and becoming, you know, kind of an Alex P. Keaton kind of thing. But but he, I always think that's interesting. And I love the whole Upson storyline.
Oh, sure.
Because first of all, Joanna Barnes, who plays Gloria, is hysterical.
And this is why I think I'm here, isn't it? This is there because of the Disney connection. Because she played Vicki Robinson in 1961's The Parent Trap.
Oh, she does. She played
Vicki Blake. The mother of Meredith Blake in the 1998 Parent Trap. So
she
like
is
mother, like daughter.
I did not realize
this
that.
This is why I'm here, because I am representing Beyond the Mouse. And this is
excellent.
Why I'm here.
Excellent.
I'm here for Joanna Barnes.
Excellent
Thank
connection.
You.
She's hysterical. That is a brilliant character that she creates, because she is the most yuppie. Her friend's Bunny Bixler, and
it was ghastly, just ghastly,
right?
You know, but it was so cool. I mean, I was doing a little bit of research, and she has some Joanna Barnes has a little pedigree, and she in fact was removed from the social from the Boston Social Register because she became an actress.
Wow.
So she knows where she and she went she, I forgot she went she she's, went to a very good school too. Wow. So she knew of
top
what
drawer.
She spoke. Yeah, top drawer.
So I can't even do it,
but it's so good. So she's
spoofing the people that ousted her.
Yes. Uh-huh. Take that, social register.
This is one of the things that I really love about this movie, is that it shows that people that claim to have the moral high ground aren't always right, you know, right. And they look down their nose at somebody like a Mame, when that character we've seen over and over again has a far more generous heart and spirit than they do. I mean, their moral high ground is only what they can project to the outside world. So yes. It's a really good message too, and
that's really a big message.
It
here,
is,
you know,
you know, and there's the dynamic between the conservative versus progressive, but I wouldn't read too much into that. It's more about are you living your life? Are you a hypocrite or not? And Mame certainly is not.
Yeah, because I love the scene where Mame goes to visit her future in-laws, at Ups and Downs, and
she was ready for anything,
and you just think, okay, these aren't Mame's type of people when you first meet them. You know, they're just overly friendly, obnoxious, the way that Gloria was. And then, of course, as you peel the layers in that scene and they talk about the Epstein place next door, that's when you really start to, figure out who these people are. And that's when, the little underlying, score of bigotry comes out. But I love Rosalind Russell in that scene, just in terms of the comedy, because they're feeding her all this food, and every little chance she gets, she can throw it over her shoulder. but then of course the
tuna
Greeks,
and peanut butter,
tuna
it's not
peanut
for
butter.
Everyone.
Yeah.
But that really would have been
clam juice.
But like Good Housekeeping magazine or whatever, the big one was in the late 50s would have had that type of recipe in there too. Yeah. Go to your local grocery, grocery market, and get this stuff and serve it to people. And and they were living the American dream, stuff like that.
They were, but of course that leads to that the great act two scene of the movie, when you get all those characters at that dinner party at the end, when where you get Vera and Patrick's old school teacher, and also Mr. Babcock, played by Fred Clark, who, poor Mr. Babcock, just can't get a break in this movie.
Yeah.
but yeah, I love, you know, you have the great set piece, because by this time, you know, we've talked about the apartment, but it starts out sort of Chinese, and then it goes to like a modern French, and then it goes to, you know, like a modern art design. And by this time, I think it's kind of like a modern, like Danish or something like what they were calling it. Mm-hmm. And she's got those, you know, levitating seats, you know, and it's such a great, it's such a great set piece. But yeah, the more and more it starts out as kind of a pleasant evening, and the more and more of her friends show up, and you know, Mame, you know, planned this to sort of reveal who these people really were. But I just love, my favorite is when you know, it's revealed that all of Mame's royalties from her book are going toward, you know, the Jewish home for, you know, refugee children. And then, you know, that causes Gloria to lean back on the pulleys and all the chairs go flying. Yeah, I mean, it's great because it deals with a very serious subject in a very funny way.
It does. Yeah. And I love, too, that the characters that she brings in, and I'm not sure who she's arguing with, but somebody says, you can't do that. You know, I'm family, or this is family, or their family. And she says, no, these are our family. All these people that have been around us and have been good people over the years, that's family. Mm-hmm.
You know, and then we get to see Patrick kind of go back to himself, find himself again.
You know,
'cause he plays with everyone so well there too. So. Yeah.
And when, is it Vera? She says, oh, Patrick, how many times in your life have you put me to bed or something like that? And, and Mr. Upson goes, please, there are young people here. He goes, well, I only put her to bed when she was drunk or something like that. But yeah, I love that. And then that's when they introduce that character of Pegeen, who later becomes, you know, Patrick's wife. And, you know, that and that's a great final scene, you know, where you realize, you know, Annie Mame is the real life Peter Pan. She's going to live forever and just keep opening new doors for, you know, these young boys. And I just love how that scene is played at the very end.
Yeah.
And her new Hindu decorated apartment.
Yes.
Right.
So but yeah, any other, I mean, we've gone through most of them, any other scenes or moments or dialogue that stick out to either one of you?
We touched on it before, but I think that the play within a play
scene, oh, we did, yeah,
is just hilarious. Just the fact that she chooses to have these charms that are loud bells on her costume ringing as she moves across the stage is just hilarious. I mean, and the main character getting in a fight too in the middle of the play is great. And then it turns on itself again, and we have that sweet moment that Brett mentioned. So I just love, I could watch that scene over again, 10 times.
Yeah. So much fun. Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the things, and we talked about this a little bit when we talked about Morton DaCosta, but I noticed it when I watched this movie and when I watched The Music Man, he does a very cinematic but theatrical thing with the camera at the end of scenes. He will fade out the entire background of the scene and just leave the characters there. And it's called, it was called the iris in, iris out effect. And it's kind of like, instead of doing a close-up, you act like you're watching a stage production. It's almost like a spotlight is just being put on these characters. And it's such a unique cinematic technique, but it looks like you're in the theater almost. And I love the way that he does that. And it's so unique to this movie. Mm-hmm. And it really gives it that special flavor.
It's a tricky shot, too. There's one where she's ascending the stairs.
Yeah.
And that happens. That means that spot has to follow her. And so... you're right. It really does look like it's a close up on that character, but it's not. It's the lighting effect that makes it look that way, and it is really unique. I enjoyed it too.
Mm-hmm. And the actress has got to love that because all of the scenes end with her. Yeah, so, like going, no, but it is about me. There, yeah. I'll share, but it's about me.
But I think it's also, when we say this movie's episodic, that sort of gives you that feel. It's like, this is the, it's like the scene ending in a stage production, and you know it's over because the lights have all gone down in that same sort of dramatic way.
Really does. And of course, the art direction, I have to give them credit. It's Malcolm Burt who did the art direction and George James Hopkins who did the sets. And it's really, this movie could have been very stage bound because it's based off of a play and it doesn't take place in too many different locations, but it feels cinematic. And I think it's because of how well the art direction, the cinematography, and all the camera work is done. I think this was a very A-list project, and they put a lot of money into it.
Successfully.
So, yeah, yay. Absolutely.
And when you
return
see
on like, investment.
Yeah, when you see all the changes that happen in the apartment, and it's completely different every time you see it, that's a trick in and of itself. I mean, they had to navigate that thing for filming too. So you couldn't have a vase sticking up here or a chair with too high of a back over here, you know, so there was that had to have been a real challenge to remake that set seven times over.
Absolutely. Yeah. So yeah, really, really interesting. Well, let's talk about real quick. Well, first of all, the Oscar nominations for this movie, because it was, when it came out, first of all, it was a huge hit. Warner Brothers was not in a good place in the late 50s. They had a string of big budget flops, and so they needed a hit. And this movie made $9 million in, 1958 money. So it was a huge hit and was nominated for 6 Oscars. Unfortunately, didn't win any. It was nominated for Best Picture. Rosalind Russell was nominated for Best Actress. Peggy Cass was nominated for Supporting Actress. It was nominated for Cinematography, Art Direction, and Editing. I don't know why the screenplay didn't get an Oscar.
Yeah.
Nomination. Oh, that. Yeah. Wow.
But the Best Picture.
It's because it's comedy. It's a comedy. That's a problem. Yeah.
Get over it. Yeah, the Best Picture winner that year was Gigi, which, another big stylish, colorful Technicolor film, a musical. And there were a lot of big powerhouse dramas that year, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof and The Defiant Ones and a lot of others. So a lot of various stuff in 58. And also, Vertigo came out that year, but was hardly nominated for anything either. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. But yeah, like we mentioned before, though, this movie came from a very famous novel written by Patrick Dennis, which was his pen name. It wasn't his real name, based on his, so everybody thought about an eccentric aunt that he had, became a play with Rosalind Russell, then became this movie. And then about 6 or 7 years later, Jerry Herman, who had just come off of a huge hit of Hello, Dolly, got the pick of anything he wanted to do, and he wanted to do a musical version of Annie Mame on Broadway, and they shortened the title, just called it Mame, and they originally offered it to Rosalind Russell to do, and she had a great line saying, "I thank you, but I really don't want to eat yesterday's potatoes," or something like that.
Okay.
and so
yes.
And so they gave it to Angela Lansbury, who was not known as a musical star at that time and became a musical star because of it.
Oh, yeah.
Had been, she was an actress who had been around for 2 decades or something like that, but had only been kind of a character actress and finally became a star in her 40s because of it. And then, of course, they were going to turn it into a musical, movie musical. And I don't think they really wanted to, because the movie version of Hello, Dolly had not been a huge box office success. But, My All Right should have been Angela Lansbury who did the movie, but Lucille Ball put up how much money, Brett, did you say?
Five million.
Wow. $5 million to do it. And they, was certainly probably at that time going to draw more box office than Angela Lansbury would have. But unfortunately, just some wrong decisions were made with that movie. And it was not great. I'm talking as a Lucille Ball fan. I just was not a good choice. I think could have been good had it been made 5 to 10 years earlier. Possibly could have done well, but There were just too many things wrong with it.
I think, you know, yeah, since we are talking about that,
we can talk about it.
We normally talk about what works.
We won't devote
a
whole episode to it. Yeah. So.
Okay. Well, what works, what
classics doesn't. Anyway.
Mame,
no.
Yeah. Mame is a musical film doesn't necessarily work. But I was, you know, I think audiences are very hard on it. And,
yeah,
you know, I think I've enjoyed it. You know, I think the problem I have, because her physical, Lucille Ball's physical comedy is good. Her dancing is amazing. And it looks great, but you know, it's a musical and she is not a good singer, you know? And if she spent, you know, the majority of her career in, you know, in her Lucy shows and all that, you know, the joke is that she can't sing and she wants to be in show business. You can't just suddenly turn on, you know, an audience that's been with you for 20 years and saying, no, I can sing, because she really couldn't, you know. Mm-hmm. And in doing the research that I did for this, you know, that she couldn't even sustain her whole, you know, a musical phrase, you know, and that they had this, you know, the audio people had to glue that thing together. So with various performances, so I'm like going, so you've signed up to do a musical when you can't sing, and you can't, and it's not that you can't sing, you can't sing because you've smoked forever, you know, or whatever. So that, yeah, you should have known better to do this, you know. But it's still fun, but it's not what it could have been. And I guess there's been talk, and I think that there's been talk, you know, about Andy Mame too, because I was reading that it was, you know, it was a Bette Midler or a Goldie Hawn or a Whoopi Goldberg, you know, possibility at some point. But I think there's such, bad feelings. Okay, there's a stank on it. There's just a big old stank on this, and it would be hard, actually, it would be hard to do that now, even if you did it as a period piece, because there are portions in this that are a little broad in their stereotypes that you just wouldn't have anymore. Mm-hmm. And makes the movie hard to watch now, for, you know, in some instances I'm like going, ooh, extremely broad and not really kind, you know, now. I never want to be a revisionist, you know, sort right. of sort of viewer, but it still, it just is, you know, it was hard to watch Ito and
right,
yeah, and other, and the Southern things too. I'm like going, because they're very broad strokes of, you know, of humor, but, you know, hey, it worked. But some of it didn't now. So I guess that gets to the what works, what doesn't. So,
but, well, I'm glad you said that. We've never shied away of pointing out problematic pieces of classics. You know, they are what they are, though. And mm-hmm. they live there. But yeah, there's definitely pieces of this movie that the stereotypes are painted with a really broad brush. And yeah, it's got its issues. You know,
some of the lines that the Upsons have are really too much.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that they even talk about a restricted community in 1958, yeah. I mean, I know that this is before the civil rights movement really took place, mm-hmm. but when you look at a calendar, that's not that long ago in American mm-hmm. history, you know, right. the
and that it was something that they held close to them, you know, you know, it was this country club lifestyle that people strive for and, you know, yearn for. I'm like going, so that was actually a very good thing about this movie, is he going, that's maybe not so good, you know. And in 1958,
right.
that was probably a very bold thing to say, you know, in the Ike years. So,
and, you know, and to have, you know, an unwed mother, as a character in this movie, Ito is definitely problematic. I think the movie at its heart is trying to paint all those characters in the best light it knows how for the time, though. So
right, for the time. It was just shortcuts to humor.
You got to come in with that Yeah, you got to come in with those types of lenses when you're looking at it. So
yeah,
I'm trying to think because, you know, this movie comes out in 58 and it's been a while since I've seen the Lucy version. But if I'm trying to remember that version, because it's in 74 and Ito at least speaks in complete sentences in that version.
Well, so, the character that played Ito was like, you know, from California. It was, you know, so he was, you know, I mean, that's,
Yeah. I mean, and the Upsons, at least they're painted as bigots, so they can at least get away with saying some of this stuff.
Okay.
But it is of its time, but like we mentioned, though, it's doing its best, and I think its intent, you know, the intentions of this movie are good. So sure. But you just have to. it's not quite as jarring as the cannibals in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea that we talked about earlier this year.
I'm sorry, I wasn't there for that one. I think James Mason.
Oh, James Mason. James was Mason there.
Was there. I wasn't there. Sorry.
And Eric, you talked about, you know, this movie not really being thought of in high regard, you know, as much anymore. In 2000, the American Film Institute did place it 94 on the 100 funniest movies of all time. And then Life is a Banquet and Most Poor Suckers Are Starving to Death was 93 on the 100 greatest movie quotes. So it kind of hovers toward the bottom of the top 100.
Yeah, but when you got a film that earned 6 Academy Award nominations for a comedy, a female-led comedy.
That's true.
Those should be higher. In my opinion. And when you have, it's certainly got its problems, but you've got a truly amazing comedic performance and a really well-written script. This should be higher up in my take.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think just the fact that you got Rosalind Russell, you know, even though it's got a solid supporting cast, I mean, she carries the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty rare in 1958. I mean, it was probably a little more common a decade earlier because, you know, there were a lot more female-driven films in the 30s and 40s. But, you know, but by the late 50s, we were in more of a John Wayne, Clint Eastwood period. So for her to really sort of carry that movie on her own was a big feat.
And it was a huge hit, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the other thing, isn't it?
Yeah, huge hit. But I do think, I think there is something to what Brett was saying. I think that, unfortunately, the film version of the musical Mame kind of put, you know, a stank on, on the film. So maybe people think of it, people unfortunately group them together when they shouldn't. And I think the problem has happened with the actual stage version of Mame too. I think it's a great stage musical, but unfortunately the movie version, we don't see too many revivals of it anymore like we would like Hello Dolly or something like that, because I think the movie version just kind of, you know, put a downer on it.
Mm-hmm.
There was Christine Baranski has played Mame, you know, in probably, I think, you know, the 90s or early 2000s, you know, but I saw it with Juliet Prowse in a touring company, and she was amazing because she was a dancer and Bob Mackie did her costumes, so she looked good.
Nice.
So
I'd like to see a revival of the actual play. I'm sure you would have to rework just a little of what we've talked about, but
I think you'd still have to keep it a period piece, because if you try to update it, you end up with, you know, the new version of the women, which was really sad. Such potential,
but I think this movie is ripe for rediscovery, and I think, you know, we're all going to be at home a lot this holiday season, and so once you've watched all your regular holiday stalwarts, I think this is a movie to give a try.
And I think when you're at home drinking and you realize how much they do in this movie, you're going to feel a lot better about yourself. So
And you'll want to add honey to everything that you do.
Yeah. Honey and clam juice. Yeah, clam
juice, peanut butter, and yeah.
So as we get close to wrapping up here, Eric, final thoughts on Annie Mame?
Yeah, if you only are familiar with Haul Out the Holly, We Need a Little Christmas Now, go check out this movie. Go in eyes wide open with everything that we've told you here. But I think you'll leave your couch, probably is where you're going to watch it, happy. I think it's going to leave you joyful. I think it's a movie with its heart in the right place and an excellent spirit. So I'd recommend watching it.
Brett?
Well, live are words to live by. How about
well
that?
Done?
Yeah. You know,
in 2020 and into 2021, please. Please. So
yeah, I think we could all use some advice going into the new year, you know.
Life's a banquet, baby. You know?
Yeah.
So. It's the right movie to end 2020 on. I think we're all ready to, you know, begin a new chapter, whatever that chapter is going to bring. But it's the best way to end it and to start it on a positive note. And this movie, it's a life affirming movie. And I think that's what we need right now. So, this was a great discussion, and I'm glad we finally got around to this movie. Brett, what is coming up for you all on Beyond the Mouse?
Oh, well, we're having some holiday episodes on Beyond the Mouse, and some of them are some episodes that have to do with holiday gift giving and Disney traditions. And then we have Disney Imagineer, our Christmas Day special is an interview with Rolly Crump, who is an Imagineer that was responsible for so many of our Disney favorites, including The Enchanted Tiki Room, and It's a Small World, and so many others. He was behind a lot of the preliminary work on The Haunted Mansion, and he has wonderful stories about Walt. And
nice.
That was, anytime you can talk to someone who can tell you about Walt is a good thing. So that's our holiday episode, and then we follow up with our review of 2020, which has been pretty amazing. So humbly we say we had a good year. So
so well, for us here on Classics, I think we maybe unfortunately have to revisit Godfather 3 next to see the new coda cut of the movie. I'm actually looking forward to seeing the changes and to see what's going on, and we'll probably join back up with Lou to discuss that. And then for our feed only episode, Jeremy's going to join us, and we're going to stay in the slapstick comedy realm, and we're going to talk about The Great Race from 65 with Tony Curtis and Jack Lemmon and Natalie Wood, and we'll stay on the very broad comedy range in that movie. But it's one of Jeremy's favorite movies, so I'm excited to talk to him about that. So, but staying fun in the new year. And of course, you guys can go back and listen to our Noirvember episodes, our interviews with Eddie Muller, which was great, and our last episode with Allison that we did on The Big Sleep was a lot of fun. And Eric, I think you and I will have to do a year end and review too, because we've had quite a year here.
We've had a great year. All in all, we've got some great things planned for 2021 already too. Some interviews and some more great discussions about great classic movies.
A friend of mine from high school messaged me and couldn't believe that we hadn't done Sound of Music yet. So she's requesting. So we're going to start the new year off by talking some Von Trapps with her. So
that's a call out to anyone. Yeah. Get in touch with us via Facebook's probably the best way to do it. And let us know if there's a movie that you would like us to discuss, and maybe we'll invite you on to discuss it with us.
Yeah. And you can contact us on our, we have a great Facebook page, Front Row Classics Podcast. It's right there on Facebook. We have an Instagram page. And then also, if you like what we're doing, find the Front Row on Patreon and give us a little bit of support so we can keep bringing you the content that we hope we can keep bringing you into 2021 and beyond. So a lot of good stuff coming on from everybody in the network. So as we close out this podcast, we hope you all have a very safe and happy holiday season wherever you are. We hope that you stay safe and that you take advantage of this banquet called life. So close out, I am Brandon.
And I'm Eric.
And I'm Brett.
And we will see you in the front row.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to this episode, a proud member of the Front Row Network of shows on NPR Illinois. For the past 5 years, we've been providing hours of content every month, and now we've created the chance for all of you to get even more content. We've officially launched our Patreon page to give you the chance to support our work. There are 4 separate levels, and each come with their own amazing bonus perks, including exclusive episodes, full movie commentary tracks, and even the ability to choose what episodes we do and be on them with us. To show your support, simply go to www.patreon.com/frontrownetwork. That's patreon.com/frontrownetwork. Thank you again, and as always, we'll see you in the front row.